Good morning. Welcome to Cruelly Treated Animals. I want to introduce you to my colleague who's going to be talking to you about these animal laws for the next hour or so. Katie Teft is our program attorney. She runs our bailiff and warrant officer program and teaches extensively for the judges, clerks, and prosecutors and court administrators in every program that we have. She's been with the center for over 2 years now. Before that, she worked as a project attorney on the 7th edition of Dawson's Texas Juvenile Law with the Juvenile Probation Commission. She was also a drafting attorney in the AG's Open Records Division, and she did her undergraduate work here in Texas at Southwestern in Georgetown and went to law school at Mercer University School of Law in Macon, Georgia. She also clerked in the Narcotics Division of the Bibb County District Attorney's Office while in law school. Welcome my colleague Katie Teft.
Thank you. Okay. Everybody awake this morning? Everybody had your couple cups of coffee? No? Well, don't worry, I'm not going to make you get up and sing and dance or anything. But we are here today to talk about a topic, and I'm glad to see more people are coming in here. Who went to the hoarding class this morning? Okay, so this is kind of a good tie-in to the hoarding class. In the hoarding class, you talked a lot about hoarding animals. And this is one way that you might get these cases other than through a city ordinance violation, but it might be that you see these cases involving these animal hoarders through the animal cruelty or cruelly treated animal provisions that we're going to talk about today. So just show of hands, how many of you have had a cruelly treated animal case in your court? Okay, three or four? How many have had a dangerous dog hearing? A couple more? We tried to do kind of an unofficial poll on the judges' listserv and ask how many, we did it to the judges' listserv and the court administrators to see how many of these cases the courts actually see. And we found that more likely than not, you saw dangerous dog hearings over the cruelly treated animal, which is surprising to me, and we'll get through some of the statistics in a minute. But why are we here today? Why are we talking about this today? When I worked at the DA's office, just to give you a little bit of background on me and why I'm interested in this topic, I worked in the narcotics division, but we also handled all of the animal cruelty prosecutions for the Middle Georgia region. So I worked on some of the big cases, the Michael Vick case, when he did the dog fighting ring in Atlanta. We consulted on that one. We had, everybody know Otis Redding sitting on the dock of the bay? I'm not going to say it's too early for me, but Otis Redding's son lives in Macon, Georgia, and his dog was killed with a machete. One of his neighbors took a machete to his head, decapitated him, drug his body behind a dumpster, and we prosecuted him under the animal cruelty statutes. Turned into a pretty interesting case, actually. He ended up fleeing. He was a sous chef at the biggest restaurant in town, the most expensive restaurant in town. When we went to search his home, we found several knife collections. His DVD collection was all Kill Bill, Pulp Fiction, all kinds of fighting stories. We found him at his parents' trailer a couple hours away from town. When the marshals went to pick him up, his parents came out with guns drawn. It turned into a huge media blitz, and we ended up having PETA on the front steps of the courthouse for a couple weeks during that trial. So that was actually the last case that I got indicted when I worked there. So when I came to Texas and I was looking at the animal cruelty laws, I know that we don't have jurisdiction over the criminal component, but we do see many of these cases. And so I got interested in this animal law topic, and we've written a series of articles in the Recorder on this, on both cruelly treated animals and dangerous dogs. And I think this is a topic we're going to see more and more. So it's a timely topic. I mean, we look at our economy today, everybody's stressed, everybody's worried. And whenever the economy is in recession, we always tend to see an increase in violence. And it might be violence against humans, it might be violence against animals. But we're seeing more and more violence against animals because of the economy, for one reason, because people are stressed, because people are looking for an outlet to vent that stress. And we're also seeing more and more people unable to afford to care for their animals. And so we're going to see more and more of these cases as the economy continues on its path right now. But we also don't really know what to do with these cases. This is pretty uncharted territory. We don't have any case law on this. We don't have many big examples. So we're kind of at a crossroads right now where we kind of have to figure out how we're going to handle these cases on our own. And we were hoping that we would get a little bit more guidance from the legislature this session. We had about four bills that were related to the municipal court's jurisdiction over these animal cases. And of those four, only one passed. And I'll tell you about it at the very end because it makes some pretty big dramatic changes. Throughout the presentation, you'll see that sometimes I have little slides that have a little dog next to them. These are practice points. We've consulted with several prosecutors who have worked on these cases, as well as judges, and they've given us things that the law might not necessarily provide, but good ideas. And so just judges, as you're going through this, if you're ever asked to consult with your cities, if your animal control officers ever come to you, this is something just to give them a little bit of feedback. Now, in preparation for teaching this class and for writing these recorder articles, I went to the Texas Academy of Animal Control Officers training school and learned what it is that the animal control officers know, because, you know, before I get up and tell the judges what they need to know, we needed to know what the people that are going to come to the judges are going to have an idea on. And so I'll give you some of the things that I learned in those classes as well, just so that you have an idea where they're coming from. But why do we even care about these classes or these cases? I mean, how many of you have pets? Almost everybody in the room. And when we talk about these animal cases, most times we're going to be talking about people's pets. You know, dogs, cats, sometimes birds. I'm going to tell you about this big Arlington case, and you'll see a video clip, and it's dealing with more exotic animals, the ones that are not the furry, cuddly kind. But overall, people love pets. People love animals. And animal cruelty is a crime. In the state of Texas, it is a crime. And as judges, as magistrates, we'll talk a little bit about the criminal components. But we often don't see it as the crime. We see it more as just the cruelly treated animal provision. And these cases do appear in your courts. Now, I had a judge one time tell me, I may be a municipal judge, I may be able to fine people, but I can also order the death penalty. And I looked at him kind of funny, and he said, I can put a dog to sleep. And I said, you know, that's true. So there is a lot of power over these cases here. But let's look first at the criminal side, just to kind of put things into perspective, and also to know this as your role as a magistrate, if you ever have an arrest warrant or an affidavit for a warrant, or have to see somebody on animal cruelty charges. So these three men, I realize that their names are in your handout, so it's not really a surprise, but anybody know who this one is? Ted Bundy. What about this one? Jeffrey Dahmer? BTK killer. And what do these three men have in common? Yep. Well, they're all serial killers who also abused and killed animals as practice. Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, used animals as practice prior to killing people. Ted Bundy was said to torture and kill animals as a child. We know he grew up to be a serial rapist and admitted to killing at least 30 women. And Jeffrey Dahmer would kill and impale the heads of animals on sticks before he ended up decapitating the humans and doing the same things with humans. Animal cruelty is really a warning sign, and lots of studies have been done on the psychology behind animal abuse. The FBI even looks at animal abuse as a child as a predictor when they're profiling serial killers. So not a big secret. Everybody's talked about this for years. The reasons that people abuse animals are sometimes, I mean, it's important to think about the reasons as well. It might be that they threaten harm to an animal to get somebody's attention. It might be a way of exerting dominance over somebody else. The wife is concerned about the pet, and so the husband will abuse the pet as a way to get back at the wife. Studies have shown that something around 85% of women who check themselves into a battered women's shelter say that it took them so long to check in because they were worried about leaving the pets in their home, because the shelters won't take pets. So they could take the children with them, but they couldn't take the pets with them. It's a way to exert dominance. It's a way to vent your anger, your frustration. Some people turn to animal abuse for curiosity reasons, just to see what it's like. It might be peer pressure, maybe a mood enhancement. It might be target practice or something to move on to something else. This session, we had a couple bills that were actually passed that will protect animals. As magistrates, you can do magistrates' orders of emergency protection. Well, now there's a law that will allow you to include pets in these protective orders. So the person that the order is against can no longer threaten abuse or abuse the animal. The animal itself wouldn't be able to come to you and ask for a protective order, but the person who's asking for it could include their animals in that protective order. And if the person that the order is against actually does threaten harm or block someone's custody or access to a family pet or an animal, then it could be an actual Class C misdemeanor offense. So there are some movements to start to protect pets more and more. There's a good paper that I've cited here in the handout if you're interested in looking at these links behind animal cruelty and violence towards people. And just as a side note on that Otis Redding case, when we went and started digging into his background, we found that not only did he have a history of abusing animals, but he also had a history of using animals to abuse people. There were situations where he would sic a dog onto a homeless person at a bus stop. And stories like that we were able to pull all this in and talk to the jury to try to convince the jury that this animal cruelty was an offense. Now, when I went to the TACO, the animal the Animal Control Authority training school, we learned that of all the animal cruelty cases, only 5% actually make it to the criminal side, where criminal charges are filed. Animal cruelty starts as a Class A misdemeanor. And so if only 5% of the time these cases actually have an information or indictment filed, that means that the other 95% of the time, we're not going to see anybody punished for these acts. And the reason being, it's not something that's really at the top of the list for law enforcement or for county or district attorneys. Law enforcement thinks we're going to deal with the more pressing crimes that have human victims. So there's kind of a mentality that law enforcement doesn't want to investigate these, as well as, we're not going to waste the prosecution resources on these cases. But if it is going to be done as a criminal offense, then we have four penal code offenses to look at. We're just going to talk briefly about these. In Texas, we love our livestock. We make a living off of livestock, so we do have it broken down by livestock and non-livestock animals. Attack on assistance animals, that's pretty self-explanatory. We do have the dog fighting statute. So let's start with the cruelty to non-livestock animals. This is going to be all of our domesticated animals. And you can be charged with cruelty to animals criminally there's 9 different reasons. So if you're charged for unreasonably failing to provide necessary food, water, or shelter, abandoning an animal unreasonably, transporting or confining an animal in a cruel manner, causing bodily injury to an animal, or seriously overworking an animal, it can be charged as a Class A misdemeanor. It's enhanceable. If you have 2 prior convictions, it bumps it up to a state jail felony. If you are torturing in a cruel manner, killing or causing serious bodily injury to an animal, if you poison or cause serious, again, that seems kind of repetitive, but poisoning or causing serious bodily injury to an animal, causing a dog to fight with another non-dog, or using a live animal as a lure in a dog race training on a racetrack. Anybody been to the Greyhound track? They always have the fake rabbit that they tied to it. So, if they were to use a real rabbit, this would be an animal cruelty. And if you commit animal cruelty in one of these 4 ways, then it is charged as a state jail felony, and it's an enhanceable to a 3rd-degree felony with 2 prior convictions. Yes? No, there are exceptions to the statutes where if it's a law enforcement officer having to act in the scope of his duties, then I think there's a defense there. So it wouldn't be, I don't think the officer would be criminally charged for anything.
Is there any further charge to the owner because of the severity of neglect?
That's a good question. Is because of the severity of the neglect, could the owner be charged when the animal has already been killed? They could still file charges against the owner. I don't know what evidence they would have to introduce it unless the animal had been seen by a vet. When we're talking animal cruelty cases, most times you want to keep the animal alive. And we'll talk about how you get, the Animal Control Authority would have to seize that animal. We had one case one time, we busted a pit bull fighting ring, and it was about 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. They had 60 pit bulls who had been trained to kill each other. And no kennel or shelter had the capability of holding all 60 of these pit bulls. And we were faced with the decision of, destroying the pit bulls because you can't put them together or having to preserve them for evidence. So we ended up having to destroy as many as we couldn't fit in the shelter and then keeping the rest for evidence and having to just charge for those that we could keep alive long enough to have a expert witness come and testify as to the condition of the animals. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are the due process concerns for destroying an animal? We'll talk about how we destroy an animal when we talk about the civil realm that we'll be dealing with in municipal court. These are just the actual criminal charges that would be filed. Now, if somebody is found guilty of animal cruelty, the purpose of the penal code provisions is to punish the actor. And when we're talking about protecting the animal or what the end result with the animal would be, we'll be talking about the civil realm. We're going to get to that in just a minute. Okay, so dog fighting. Dog fighting is also a Class A misdemeanor under the penal code. In 2009, the legislature made it easier to charge somebody with dog fighting simply by owning or possessing dog fighting equipment. Prior to that, you had to actually own or train the dog or attend the dog fight as a spectator. But now just owning or possessing the equipment itself can be charged as a Class A misdemeanor. can also be charged as a state jail felony if you're causing the dog to fight, if you profit at all from the dog fighting ring, or if you allow somebody to use your property in order to conduct dog fighting, then it can be charged as a state jail felony. Okay, so when we talk about animal cruelty, usually people think of the criminal side of animal cruelty, either dog fighting or actually abusing the animal, in which case, it's a crime. You're arrested for that crime. They'll come to you as a magistrate, ask for an arrest warrant. They'll go pick up the person, have an information or indictment filed, depending on what level of offense it's risen to. The person will be a defendant. They'll have to go through a trial. And the purpose behind the animal cruelty statutes is to actually punish the actor. We're not as concerned with the animal at that point. We're concerned with punishing the animal. It's a penal offense. We want to punish them. And we're going to conduct these under the rules of criminal procedure, pursuant to the penal code and the code of criminal procedure. But when we talk about the cruelly treated animal statutes that we're going to deal with in municipal court, we're going to look at the civil side. So this is one of the few civil realms of jurisdiction that we have in municipal court. We're not concerned with punishing the actor here. We're not concerned with arresting the defendant. He's not even a defendant. Instead, our goal under the cruelly treated animal statutes in municipal and justice court is to protect the animal. We're going to have a respondent, not a defendant. We're going to have a hearing, not a trial. It's going to be a civil matter. We're going to operate under the rules of civil procedure. So this is going to be quite different than anything that we're used to dealing with. And rather than using the Code of Criminal Procedure, the Penal Code, everything we're going to do is under the Health and Safety Code. Now, as I said, 95% of animal cruelty investigations stop at this civil level, and they're only going to go through the municipal or the justice court. And we found that we don't even see that many. So that might be positive that we don't have many animal cruelty cases that we're dealing with. It might be that they just kind of get lost in the system, that somebody will investigate them, the DA will decline prosecution, and nothing ever happens to the animal. But it is kind of a staggering number to think that 95% of these cases come to us, that we have control over 95% of these. Now, when we talk about cruelly treated animals, everything we're going to talk about is in Chapter 821 of the Health and Safety Code. This is all under Subchapter B. It's a whole 2 pages. So if you have the big brick book, and you ever have one of these animal cruelty hearings come through your court, I'd recommend reading those 2 pages. It's not that many statutes. Thankfully, the legislature's tried to clean these up. If you've ever done a dangerous dog, you know that that's pretty convoluted and circular and doesn't make much sense. But the cruelly treated animals are a little bit easier to understand. So in the Health and Safety Code, they define cruelly treated. And if you look at these ways that an animal can be cruelly treated, they look identical to the ways that you can actually commit the offense of animal cruelty. You can torture an animal, seriously overwork an animal, unreasonably abandon, unreasonably deprive them of necessary food, water, or shelter, confine them in a cruel manner, or cause them to fight with another animal. And these are all the ways that somebody can be found to have cruelly treated an animal. So when it comes up to you as judges to make the determination of if an animal has been cruelly treated, we go by this definition that's in the Health and Safety Code. Cruelly treated animals, the way we're going to walk through the process, we're going to look at how these cases come to be heard in your court. We're going to talk about the hearing and what happens at the hearing. We'll talk about the end, the disposition, what the rules are for destroying an animal, and then also what the appeal process would be. So the way you will get these cases in your court, they should be bringing the cases to you. It might be your animal control authority, your animal control officers. Perhaps it's your city attorney who's the one that's bringing the case. But the cases should come to you, not something that you should have to go out and look for. When the case comes to you, the peace officer or the animal control officer should apply for a warrant to seize the animal. So they should come to you with some sort of affidavit for a seizure warrant saying that they believe that the animal has been cruelly treated. They'll have to show probable cause. It is a seizure warrant, so they would have to show probable cause for why they believe that this animal is being or has been cruelly treated. That officer can apply either to a JP or a municipal court judge or to any magistrate for the county where that animal is being housed or where that cruel treatment is occurring. We have a sample affidavit for a seizure warrant in the handouts at the back of the book, so if somebody ever asks you for a sample affidavit or something, not that the judges should be providing that, but they should. You do have a sample to see what one might look like. Now, if the officer applies for the warrant to seize the animal, these are a couple of the practice points. It's recommended that your city attorney have already viewed the seizure warrant to make sure that there is probable cause there. What good does it do for them to bring you an affidavit for a seizure warrant if there is no probable cause? As a judge, you wouldn't be able to sign that. So the city attorney should probably review that PC affidavit prior to the presentation to you. If an animal is seized, the owner is going to attack the probable cause in that affidavit. That's the only way the owner really can attack that seizure. is to go after the probable cause. Now, sometimes we're talking one dog. Sometimes we're talking 27,000 animals at a warehouse. Depending on how many animals are, we don't have to sign a separate seizure warrant for every animal. It can be as a class of animals. It can be for one animal. The warrant can be for as many as you have to have. But in the probable cause affidavit, the person, the affiant, should list as to why each animal is being cruelly treated. And if there are so many that they can't break it out as to why each one, then list why as a class these animals, as a whole, the conditions as a whole, constitute cruel treatment. So don't panic if you have somebody wanting to seize 100 animals that you have to sign 100 seizure warrants or determine probable cause for each of those 100. If you find probable cause in that seizure warrant, then you shall issue the warrant and set a hearing to determine whether or not that animal has been cruelly treated within 10 calendar days. Now, this is going to be different. We're not talking business days. We're not talking court days. How many part-time judges out there? Okay, so if you're not in the court every week or every day, then this might be problematic because the law just says within 10 calendar days you have to have this hearing. This is why it's so important that the city attorney already review the PC affidavit before it's presented to you, because that hearing is going to be held within 10 days no matter what. That means the city has less than 10 days to get ready for this hearing. There are no rules on continuation. We'll get to that in a second. But from the date that you issue that seizure warrant, there's only 10 days until that hearing is going to be held. Now, when this warrant is issued, how do you style that warrant? We're not talking a criminal case. We don't have a defendant. It's not state of Texas versus anybody or city versus anybody. It's going to be an in re the animals that are being seized. This is about the animals again. When we're talking civil, we're talking about the animals. So we're going to style the case in re animals or the description of the animals. It might be in re Fido, a beagle, and describe the beagle itself. It's not something that's against the owner. So that's just something you'll see in the forms even, that the sample cases that we've given you in the handouts, there was even the courts made a mistake in that one as well. So just note that this is a civil matter, and so we're going to style it in re. Once that seizure warrant is issued by you, then the officer needs to go and execute that warrant by impounding the animals. Those animals have to be impounded in humane and secure conditions. And then the officer also has to give notice to the owner that they're seizing it from of the time and the date and the place of the hearing. So in your seizure warrant, it might be smart to include the date and time of the hearing in the warrant itself. That way you're not having to send a separate notice. Of course, this relies on the animal control officer actually giving them a copy of the warrant. So hopefully you trust your animal control officers enough to provide this notice. But it's easy to have everything in one spot. Now, the law doesn't contemplate how long they have to issue this warrant. Now, we know under search warrant laws in the Code of Criminal Procedure, a search warrant expires after 3 days. But we're not going under the Code of Criminal Procedure. We're working under the Health and Safety Code, and so we don't have a timeline. We just know that the hearing has to be held within 10 days. And because we are seizing somebody's property, the owner is entitled to due process by notice and an opportunity to be heard. So if they don't have received notice within that 10-day period, how can we seize the animal after that hearing is supposed to have occurred? As a judge, it might also be something to consider. If the seizure warrant isn't executed until day 9 and the hearing is scheduled for day 10, has the owner really gotten due process? Have they had time to prepare for this hearing? Probably not. So although the law doesn't tell us how long the officer has to execute that warrant, it kind of contemplates that it be done immediately. And, of course, our concern here is for the safety of the animals, so why would they want to wait on this? Yes?
I'm just confused about the 10 days, because originally this guy had 6 animals, so he wanted to sell 4, he decided too many, unlicensed, rabies shots, and he's got a lot of stuff. But that animal captain is not used to this.
Okay.
He has so long to come to the court and plead.
Well, you're talking, he's pleading to criminal, to city ordinances. So we're not going to go under the Chapter 821 of the Health and Safety Code.
No, we are actually
with the
to.
Is that a city ordinance, failure to provide? Okay. And we'll talk at the very end. I was going to mention this. Everything we're talking about are the laws in Chapter 821 of the Health and Safety Code. Several cities have adopted ordinances that mirror the provisions in Chapter 821. And if your city has done that, hopefully there's not a preemption issue. I tend to think that if the law is already spelled out under state law, I don't know why there's a need to have a city ordinance. But I have seen cities that have adopted a criminal penalty for failing that kind of mirrors the ways that you can provide cruel treatment. Now, I've talked to the city attorney in the city of Arlington, And she doesn't, Arlington wanted to do something similar where they created a Class C offense out of animal cruelty. She said, I'm not going to do it because I think it's preempted by state law. But if you do have a city ordinance and nobody's raised a preemption issue to it, then I think you operate under your city ordinance and not under Chapter 821 of the Health and Safety Code. But if the officer's coming to you under Chapter 821 with the affidavit for a seizure warrant, then we would follow these guidelines. We'd have to have that hearing within 10 days. The seizure warrant, they have to have notice and notice of the hearing and the hearing time. Yeah, if you're operating under a city ordinance, then I would do what your city ordinance does. And if you're doing it criminally, then you would follow the same rules we do for any other city ordinance violation. Okay, so the officer will impound the animal and give written notice to the owner, and then we go to the hearing. That hearing has to be held within 10 calendar days of the date that the seizure warrant was issued. Not executed or served, but the date that you signed it, which again means that the city has no more than 10 days to prepare. Now, when we're talking about notice, we have to figure out who the owner is. Of course, the owner is entitled to notice. If we're talking about a business, then we have to follow the rules that say that the business has to receive notice. However, any acts of an agent of the business or an employee of the business are considered acts of the corporation itself. So the notice would just have to be given to the owners of the business. They might come back and challenge that, say they weren't properly given notice. But the law does tell us in Chapter 821 that any acts of the employees or the agents are considered acts in knowledge of the corporation as well. So it just makes it a little bit easier for us to prove the cruel treatment of the animals because, again, we're not concerned with punishing the person who's committing the cruel treatment. Instead, we're concerned with protecting the animal itself. Now, at the hearing, all the law tells us is that any interested party is entitled to present evidence. It doesn't tell us who the interested parties are. It says that this can include the owner. Obviously, they'd be an interested party. It can include the city or the state. So it might be your city attorney, your city prosecutor is going to present evidence. It might be animal control authority is going to present evidence. But it just says any interested party. And so questions have come up. Who else could be an interested party? A neighbor. I mean, and as judge, you're going to be the one to determine whether or not somebody has relevant testimony that could make them an interested party. It could be PETA tries to get involved in a lot of these, and you would have to decide whether PETA would be considered an interested party, whether they have some interest in this animal. Perhaps a neighbor, if the animal is getting into the neighbor's yard quite a bit. If there's a potential victim, maybe the victim would be an interested party. We know the owner can be there, and we know that somebody from the city needs to be there to present evidence. Otherwise, who's going to present that evidence of the cruel treatment? The law also tells us that the owner doesn't even have to be at the hearing. All that the law requires is that they be given notice of the hearing and an opportunity to be heard, but they don't have to avail themselves of that opportunity. So whereas in the criminal realm, we're not going to proceed without the defendant being there, in the civil realm, we don't have a defendant, we have a respondent, and so the respondent doesn't have to be present, they just have to have been provided that written notice. Now when we talk about the hearings, we have a lot of unanswered questions, and again, this is where we hope the legislature would come in and clean this up, and we weren't that lucky. Do the rules of evidence apply? What are your thoughts? Yes. And I think presumably yes. I mean, when we're talking hearings, rules of evidence, the rules of evidence, Rule 101B, says that these rules govern civil proceedings in all courts of Texas except for small claims courts. So arguably the rules of evidence are going to apply. We'll have to be concerned with the rule if we have multiple witnesses. When we're talking about these cruel treatment cases, most of us could look at a dog and know if the dog has been starved or if the dog has been beaten or has open sores on them. But how many of us could look at a horse and tell if the horse is underweight for its age? I mean, it's going to be a little bit harder to prove cruel treatment for animals that we're not as familiar with. And so this is one of the few times that we might actually have expert witnesses come in to have to testify. We might have zoologists. We might have veterinarians that have to be sworn in. Then we would have to worry about getting them certified as an expert witness. So the rules of evidence would apply, and we do have them on our website if you're not as familiar with the rules of evidence, but that's something that we would have to look into. Now, what about the rules of civil procedure or criminal procedure? I said earlier that these are civil hearings. Case law makes it clear that these are civil hearings. So we would arguably use the rules of civil procedure. However, the rules of civil procedure say that they only apply to justice, county, and district courts, and not corporation courts, which municipal courts have evolved from corporation courts. So there's also an argument that the rules of civil procedure don't apply. But how can we have a hearing without some sort of rules of procedure? So When we're talking about the cruelly treated animal, this is still kind of an area that hasn't been cleaned up. It's not a criminal procedure, so we wouldn't go by the rules of criminal procedure. The rules of civil procedure can be used whenever they are not at odds with what's in health and safety code. But if you're any civil practitioners out there, so familiar with the rules of civil procedure. If you look at the rules of civil procedure for justice courts, there are deadlines. You have 21 days of notice. You have there are jury fees that have to be paid if you want a jury trial. And those wouldn't make sense in the animal cruelty statutes or in Chapter 821 of the Health and Safety Code because it tells us we have 10 days till we have to have the hearing. So wherever the rules of civil procedure are not at odds with Chapter 821, probably look to those rules of civil procedure if you can. We were hoping that they would actually straight out tell us that we have to do that, and then we could actually go through and try to identify what rules, you know, we should go by. But again, because we don't have very clear answers here, these are cases in your court, and as judge, you get the opportunity to decide how you want these cases to proceed. But the biggie, the million-dollar question that we have when we're talking about these civil animal cases is whether or not the owner has the right to a jury trial. So let me poll you. What do you think? Owner comes to you and says, I want a jury trial. Do you think they have a right to a jury trial? Raise your hand if you say yes. Raise your hand if you think no. Those of you who have had these hearings before, have you had a jury trial? No. Okay. Well, we don't have an answer. And this is why I hate teaching these classes where we don't have an answer, because I want to have a black or white answer to be able to give you, but I don't. My gut reaction is no. We don't have a defendant. This isn't a trial. This is a hearing. If you read the statutes in Chapter 821, it says a time for a hearing. A hearing shall be set within 10 days. When do you have jury hearings? We don't. It says if the court finds. Everything relates to the court, not to a jury. There's no procedure for waiver of a jury trial. There's no procedure for election of punishment by a jury. Everything just refers to a hearing in the court. So on my first reaction, I said there is no right to a jury trial. However, anybody want to throw out the counterpoint there? Yes. Mm-hmm. Because a property seizure case, people have the right. You should be secure in your life, liberty, and property. And so if we're going to take somebody's property away, there should be a right to a jury trial. Now, there's one case that talks about cruelly treated animals, and this is Granger versus Folk. This is a Beaumont Court of Appeals case from 1996, and they argue that the respondents, that the animal owners, do have a right to a jury trial, but they cite the U.S. Constitution as grounds for the jury trial, and they never address Texas Supreme Court case law or the Texas Constitution on the right to jury trials in civil matters. Now, if you've read, anybody read this article in the Recorder? This was the January issue. We had the big article about animal cruelty and cruelly treated animal cases. And at the end of my article, David Johnson with the City of Arlington, who's one of the city prosecutors who works primarily on these cases, wrote up an article. And when he teaches this class to the judges as well, his answer is no, there is no right to a jury trial. He's done the research. They asked for a jury trial. In one of the cases he worked on, they even appealed it, saying they were denied their right to a jury trial. And his argument is there is no right to a jury trial. And his rationale is, and I tend to buy into this a little bit, but his rationale is that if you look at the Texas Constitution, Article 1, Section 15 says that the right of trial by jury shall remain inviolate. The legislature shall pass such laws as may be needed to regulate the same and to maintain its purity and efficiency. Legal scholars have argued that the legislature can deny your right to a jury trial in cases where no such right existed in common law at the time that the Constitution took effect back in 1876. And back in 1876, there was no cruelly treated animal provisions. There were no animal hearings. What about the Seventh Amendment? The Seventh Amendment has not been incorporated to the states through the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. Seventh Amendment is the one exception there. So there's a pretty good explanation if you look in the Recorder article that goes through the different steps. David also did a webinar on this topic where he goes through, spends about 15 minutes looking at the right to a jury trial. End result, I think that if you're going to deny the right to a jury trial, you're safe in doing so, because we don't have any case law that tells us that we do have a right to a jury trial. There's the one Granger case. It, again, I think incorrectly cites some of these, some of the constitutional grounds for being able to have the right to a jury trial. There is no case law that's directly on point. We have very limited case law in this area, period. but we have nothing that's directly on point, and we have nothing that is from the high court. Everything is an intermediate court of appeals decision. Everything is at odds with each other. We have nothing from the Court of Criminal Appeals, which would probably argue they don't have jurisdiction because it's not a criminal matter, and we have nothing from the Texas Supreme Court either that says one way or another whether there's a right to a jury trial in this case. So most judges have said no, there is no right to a jury trial solely because it's a hearing and it's up to the court to find these things. Other judges have granted a jury trial, but then we open the door to the rules of civil procedure where do they have to pay a jury fee? Under the rules of civil procedure, you do. Do you have to, how are you going to impanel a jury within 10 days? That's going to be a big problem for most of our municipal courts, is to be able to get the jurors to actually show up if that hearing has to be held within 10 days. Now, there is one case, and this was, I believe, Russo versus State. This is a decision out of the First District Court of Appeals in Houston in 2005, and they argued that because the respondent never made a request for a jury trial and because they never paid the jury trial fee under the rules of civil procedure, that they weren't entitled to a jury trial. They don't say that, though. Well, yes, except for the fact that they say that the point is moot because they never made the request anyway, so that we're not going to analyze it. So they don't even, it's just kind of a dicta. They throw it in there as one sentence. Other cases that we, there are four cases that we have, one out of the Dallas Court of Appeals and one out of the 14th District in Houston that talk about the cruelly treated animal provisions, and all of them originate out of a JP court. None of them originate out of a municipal court. So, again, I mean, that's kind of positive for us that we don't have any municipal court judges who are being appealed on the basis of denying a jury trial. But, again, we're hoping that we can get some more guidance in this. And at the very end, I'll tell you what the legislature did do because I don't want to confuse anything. As the law stands right now, we don't have it's silent on the issue of whether or not you have a right to a jury trial. Okay, any other questions on the hearing? I know this is kind of an unclear area. Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay. The judge's point is that the law just says it has to be held within 10 calendar days or set within 10 calendar days. So he started the hearing and then allowed a continuance for both sides to have more time. Again, there's nothing in the law that says that you can do that, and there's nothing that says you can't do that. It's kind of silent on continuances as well. But again, you're the judges. You're the ones that have control over these cases. So if you want to grant a continuance, I don't see any reason why the judge couldn't grant a continuance. At the hearing itself, though, this is where we do get some ideas of what we have to do. So thankfully, the legislature has filled in, said we're not going to tell you what has to happen at the hearing, but we're going to tell you what has to happen at the end of the hearing. If you find that there is no cruel treatment, if you find that they haven't established all of the elements of cruel treatment. Now, again, this is a civil matter, so we're not concerned about beyond a reasonable doubt. Because we're dealing with the civil, we're looking at probably a preponderance of the evidence standard. But if you find that there is no cruel treatment, then you order that the animal be returned to the owner, end of case. We don't have any options here, but we just order that the animal be returned, end of case. However, if you find that there is evidence of cruel treatment, then the owner is divested of ownership of the animal, and you have three options. So you will divest the owner of ownership, and then you get to pick one of the following three. You can order that the animals be sold at a public sale or auction. You can order that the animals be given over to a nonprofit animal shelter, the pound, or some sort of society for the protection of animals. Or you can order that the animal be humanely destroyed if that's in the best interest of the animal or would serve the public health and safety. So get to do one of the three things. If you order that the animal be given to a shelter, then you can, or be sold, then you can order that the animal be spayed or neutered at the expense of the person who ultimately takes possession of the animal. Of course, if we're going to order the animal destroyed, there'd be no need to do that. If you find that there is evidence of cruel treatment, then again, we're going to divest the owner of ownership, we're going to order one of three dispositions, and then you also order the owner to pay court costs. And this is where the legislature is screwing things up, and clerks call all the time and want to know, what are the court costs on this? We're not dealing with the court costs that are going to have to go to the state. These cases don't even get reported to the comptroller. They're civil cases. We're not going to collect our criminal court costs that we usually do. But they do call these things court costs, and these include the costs of the investigation. So if the animal control was making an investigation and had any outstanding costs there, if there were any expert witnesses that had to be called to testify, then the owner could be ordered to pay the cost of those expert witnesses, to pay the city back. Any costs for housing and caring for the animal during its impoundment, so from the time that the animal was seized until the disposition hearing, that could be those 10 days. It might be shorter depending on when the hearing was and when the seizure happened. Those can be charged back to the owner. And then any cost for conducting the sale, if you order that the animal be sold, or if you order the animal be destroyed, then the owner could be charged to pay the cost for the destruction of the animal as well. Now, they do call this court costs. I think of this more as restitution. You're basically ordering the owner to pay back the city for all of the costs that it incurred during this process. Now, if you listen to David Johnson's webinar, or if you read his article, one of the points is that to always have evidence of the court costs ready to be presented. Now, what happened in the case that David talks about, in the Arlington case I'll show you in just a second, they didn't present evidence of the costs until after, and the statute says that at the time you find that the animal has been cruelly treated, that this is all supposed to be contained in the same order. You're divesting them of ownership, you're ordering the disposition, and you're ordering payment of the court costs. And they didn't present evidence of the cost to the city until the end because they were concerned that the judge might not order the animals, you know, might find differently if he realized how much the city had spent in all this and how much he would have to tell the owners to pay. And then at the end, they weren't able to present any of this evidence because all of this is supposed to happen in one hearing. So this is a reason why your city attorneys might be involved in this, or why somebody from the city needs to be there to present evidence, because if the city is going to recoup any of the costs for this process, they have to present this evidence at the hearing as well for you all to order in the disposition order. Yes?
The language is shall, so we don't have a
choice. To order court costs? Correct. I mean, if they present evidence, it says that the court shall order that you pay, that you order the... The court shall order that the owner be responsible for these costs. Well, shall means must, so I would think that the judge would have to order these. But, of course, you can find that they haven't presented enough evidence to prove up the cost to the city. I mean, I think if the city's coming forward and saying, it's going to cost us $10,000 or it cost us $10,000 to conduct this investigation, as judges, you have the right to inquire and say, how in the world could it have cost you $10,000 to do this? I haven't heard of really high amounts of costs that judges have ordered under these cruelly treated animal provisions. Okay, so if, as the disposition, again, you have the three options. You can order that it be sold, you can order that it be given away, or you can order that it be destroyed. If you order that the animal be sold at a sale, then we have to post notice of the auction, and this could be posted in your newspaper, it can be posted at the courthouse, however public auctions are done in your city. We'd have to post notice of that auction. When the animal is sold, all of the proceeds that come in from the sale of that animal first go to, are first applied to the costs that were ordered that the owner pay. So if the owner was ordered to pay, you know, $100, and that was the cost of housing the animal, everything else, that's probably a low estimate, but let's say the owner was ordered to pay $100, and that animal sold for $150, then out of that $150, that would satisfy your order for costs. The extra $50 or any excess proceeds go back to you to then return to the owner who was divested ownership. So it seems a little weird here that here we have an owner who has cruelly treated his animals, might go after him criminally down the road, but now we're at the civil level and he's been divested of ownership and he might actually profit from having injured these animals or abused these animals because the animals sell for more. We find this a lot in cases of horses. I mean, you know, we have horses that go up for auction that are going to bring in a lot of money. Miniature horses. There was a case where miniature horses were being sold for $5,000, and the costs that were ordered were, you know, less than that, and they're selling 10 horses, and so all these proceeds went back to the owner. However, the former owner cannot bid at the auction. Neither can the former owner's agent come and bid at the auction. If the animal does not sell at the auction, then it would come back to you to determine an alternate method of disposition. So if you order that the animal be sold, you might now instead order that the animal be given away to an animal shelter or a nonprofit agency. If you find that it's in the animal's best interest, then you could order that the animal be destroyed. But if it doesn't sell, then we turn to one of the other two methods. We would never give the animal back to the owner itself. If you order that the animal be given away to a shelter, then that's easy. It just goes to the animal shelter. Again, the owner would still have to pay costs. in that manner, because this is a civil action. If the owner doesn't pay the cost, then we would enforce payment of those costs through a writ of attachment or execution of property or some other method that we would get the owner to satisfy those costs. If we order the same thing, if we order the animal be destroyed, then the owner would have to pay those costs through some other method. We'd have to go after him that way. Okay, appeal. Ooh, that got really loud. Yes. Right, yeah. So the law, the legislature really clarified all the rules on appeal back in 2009. Any owner who was divested of ownership has the right to appeal. Now, prior to 2009, the owner only had the right to appeal if you ordered that the animal be sold. But if you ordered that the animal be given to a nonprofit or worse, destroyed, the owner had no right to appeal. That didn't make sense. So in 2009, the legislature changed it and said any owner who's divested of ownership has a right to appeal. The appeal is going to be taken either to the county court or the county court at law. And we do have strict time deadlines. Before, we had no deadlines. It just said an owner whose animal was ordered sold can appeal, but it didn't tell you when to appeal. Well, that didn't really help anybody because, like the judge said, I mean, if we say that the animal has to be sold and we sell the animal in 5 days and the owner appeals after 30, then you have a huge mess. Got to get the animal back, figure out what to do with it. Worse, if you're ordering the animal destroyed and now the owner has a right to appeal, how do you know at what point to destroy it? So the law does give us strict time deadlines and tell us when it has to happen. The owner has to file the notice of appeal and appeal bond within 10 calendar days from the date that you issue that disposition order. So we're sticking with the same theme here. We had, you know, from the date that the warrant is issued, we have 10 days to have a hearing. Let's say the hearing occurs in 1 day. It might take a week, who knows. But from the date that you sign that order, at the end of the hearing, the owner has 10 days to then appeal that determination. They have to post an appeal bond, and you as judges get to set the amount of that appeal bond. Now, it has to be an amount that's adequate to cover the estimated expenses for housing and caring for that animal through the pendency of the appeal. And the law tells us how long that appeal is going to be so that we can have a pretty good estimate. Now, if the city has already presented evidence of the amount of the cost for caring for the animal during the time it took to have the hearing, you have that information in front of you. I mean, if they say it costs us $250 a day to care for this animal or these animals, then you can say, okay, so I'm going to set the appeal bond at $250 times the number of days that this appeal could last. If you don't have that evidence in front of you, if nobody has presented evidence of costs, then as judge, you would need to look into that amount to be able to set the amount of that appeal bond. The difference here on these appeal bonds, we're not talking about appearance bonds. So in criminal matters, you know, we have them post an appeal bond because we're going to make them show up. If they don't show up, then we can forfeit that bond. When we're talking these civil animal hearings, we're not worried about the owner actually appearing. Instead, we're just worried about being able to cover the cost for caring for that animal. And so these bonds are not conditioned on them actually appearing. They have 10 days to file that appeal bond, which means that the animal has been in custody for 10 more days. And then the court has 5 days to send over the court's record to wherever that appeal was taken, to either the county court or the county court at law. So you have 5 calendar days from the date the appeal is perfected to send over all the information to the county court. So now they've had 10 days to appeal. You have 5 days to send it over. And the county court has 10 days to rule from the date that they receive that. So when we're setting the amount of the appeal bond, the maximum amount of time that an appeal can last is 25 calendar days. So when you're estimating the cost of that appeal bond, it's going to be however much it costs to care for that animal for 1 day times 25 maximum. Now, if they appeal on day 2, you have 5 days to get it over, and they still have 10 days. So it could be shorter than 25, but every deadline is going to run from the date that something actually happens. The court has to send over, the law says that the court shall deliver the court's transcript. So this has raised a lot of questions. If you're a court of record, you're probably equipped to set up and have an actual transcript made. Now, in a criminal matter, the defendant has to request it. The defendant has to pay for it. We don't have any of those rules here. If you're a court of non-record, which I mean, most of you, I'm assuming, are courts of non-record, you're not going to have a transcript made. And so if you look to the rules of civil procedure, we can kind of equate when they say transcript, they're really talking about the court's record. So anything you would send over for the regular appeal from a criminal matter is what you would send over for the appeal for one of these cases. The standard of review on an appeal If we're talking about a court of record, they argue that it would be actually based on the record because you would have the transcript. If you're a court of non-record, it would be de novo review at the county level. And so once it gets to the county, they have 10 days. And so, again, they'll have 10 days to have a hearing and start this whole process over. And that's going to be the same timelines that we've had in the municipal court. So no more than 25 days for determining the appeal process, and the county court decision is final. There's no way to appeal from the county court decision. This might explain why we have such limited case law in this matter, because if they can only appeal out of the municipal court and it gets to the county court, they're going to have to do some sort of habeas claim to be able to get this appeal even further up, and we don't have any published case law out of a county court. So that might be why we have very limited case law here and why we have very few answers in this area. Now, while the appeal is pending, we cannot do anything with the animal. We have to keep the animal, keep everything as the status quo. So if they have 10 days to appeal, but in your disposition order you've ordered that the animal be sold or given away or destroyed, I wouldn't do it for 10 days because we know that they have 10 days to appeal, and if they do appeal, then we can't do anything with the animal. He cannot be sold or given away. The animal can only be destroyed if it's necessary for the animal. So if we have an animal that's actually in pain, is suffering, is extremely ill, then we can order the animal be destroyed if it's necessary to prevent undue pain and suffering. Okay, any questions on the appeal process? All right, so let me tell you about a couple cases that we have. I'm trying to figure out where the video clip is. Let me see real quick. Go ahead and skip ahead and show this video clip. So this whole topic kind of came about because we had this huge case. Everybody heard about the City of Arlington case, the cruelly treated animal case? This was the largest cruelly treated animal case and animal seizure in the United States. In the City of Arlington, there was a company called U.S. Global Exotics. They were an exotic animal wholesaler. Owners were from Australia. They ran this exotic animal company out of the City of Arlington, had a big warehouse. And PETA put an undercover investigator as a staff member into this facility for several months. And this undercover, PETA's people for the ethical treatment of animals. So PETA put in an undercover investigator into this warehouse, and this investigator would report back things that this warehouse was doing that would constitute cruel treatment. And then the City of Arlington went in and did a seizure warrant for these 27,000 animals. This was something where they highly had the city involved up front because, you know, seizing 27,000 animals took several days. So before they got that seizure warrant signed by the judge, before they ever presented that affidavit to the judge, they made sure that they had everybody lined up to help. They had a facility where they could take the animals. They had veterinarians on call to be able to care for the animals once they were seized, because the seizure process did take quite a long time. So I'm going to show you the video clip, and then we'll talk a little bit about some of the issues that came up.
No water, food, or bedding. That's how a judge describes the living conditions for thousands of animals inside an Arlington business. For the first time, we're getting to see what it was like inside U.S. Global Exotics from disturbing video released today. Channel H's Jim Douglas joins us live from Arlington with more on that. Jim, this is tough to hear.
Yeah, it's the largest seizure of its kind, and what today's ruling means is the City of Arlington now has legal custody of about 27,000 exotic animals, some 500 different species. And as you said, some of the video you're about to see might be disturbing. They're safe now, fed and tended to by the SPCA at an undisclosed location. After several days of testimony, an Arlington municipal judge ruled they were cruelly treated at U.S. Global Exotics, which sells the animals to buyers worldwide. Now that the judge has revoked ownership, we can reveal photos and video taken inside Global Exotics by an undercover operative for PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. It shows a suffering wallaby, injured reptiles, fouled water.
Left to sit sometimes for weeks without light, food, water, space, or anything that they needed to sustain themselves. And that's against the law, period.
The owner of Global Exotics argued that his facility met industry standards. An attorney for PETA says the judge's ruling shows the law trumps industry standards.
In an industry that's going to treat living creatures like they were nuts and bolts and little drawers in the wall, we're going to put a stop to that.
A spokesman for the SPCA says it's averaging $8,000 to $10,000 a day just to care for the animals. They cannot be sent to new homes until Global Exotics exhausts any appeals it might file.
but sanctuaries and zoos are showing interest.
We've never dealt with anything of this size. Nobody has in this country.
James Bias says about 4,000 animals have died since they were seized. He says some were euthanized, while others succumbed to long-term neglect.
Now the mortality rate has just dropped down significantly, and we're seeing these animals now thrive.
Today's ruling was part of a civil seizure case. The owners of U.S. Global Exotics could now face criminal charges for animal cruelty. Their attorney did not return our call. Live in Arlington, Jim Douglas, Channel 8 News.
Okay, so in the Arlington case, we see a lot of the issues that we've discussed here. It was 27,000 animals. Those animals included chinchillas, Kodamundi, frogs, hamsters, hedgehogs, iguanas, kinkajous. I mean, who would know what a kinkajou was? This is where we definitely would need some experts to come in. Lizards, prairie dogs, sloths, snakes, spiders, and turtles. They went in, they seized the animals. During the hearing lasted 7 days. This was all right about Christmas time, so this was a seven-day-long hearing in municipal court. Judge Mike Smith was the judge who presided over this hearing. He was actually named the TMCA Judge of the Year based on his work on this hearing. I've given you a copy of the order he wrote at the end of this hearing. It's about a 6-page order where he detailed all of his findings as to how they found cruel treatment for all 27,000 animals that were seized. He said that evidence was received which indicated that this facility was operated in accordance with industry standards of the exotic animal trade. While this may be true, this court is not free to substitute those standards for the standards set by Texas statutes. And he found that the facility was extremely understaffed, that they had 3 caretakers for all of these animals. Experts testified that they would need at least 20 to 40 caretakers to provide adequate care for all of these animals. He found that the urine and death smell was so great that it provided poor air quality. When they went in for the seizure, people had to go in with masks to prevent the smell of ammonia. So this is another thing where in the hoarding class, they talked about how sometimes these houses are so unsafe that the city needs to go after them as a sanity concern. But when these animals are, when you have all these animals and the urine from these animals, I mean, it's not something that you can just walk in and take the animals out. The city needs to be set up and staffed and equipped correctly to go in with masks and, you know, for their own protection. He also found that the overcrowding was so bad. We saw a picture in there of all of the hamsters that were stacked on top of each other, that it led to fighting, disease, and cannibalism. The greatest example he found was a situation where there were 414 iguanas. There was an order placed for 414 iguanas. They were packed up in a crate. They were rolled up in bags and put in boxes for shipment, and the order was canceled. And 2 weeks later, they went in and unpacked the boxes. These iguanas had no food, water, air, or light. Because this order was canceled, nobody had checked on them in over 2 weeks, and over 200 of the iguanas died. So that was one of the examples that he said led to the decision that these animals had been cruelly treated. Now, we heard that the SPCA was averaging $8,000 to $10,000 a day in cost to care for these animals, but the city didn't present this information of cost, so in his case, no costs were ordered to be paid by the owners. Yes? This is all the civil. Uh-huh.
So the Fourth Amendment doesn't kick in. We don't need to find probable cause that blindness is committed or any of that.
Okay. The question is, because this is civil, does the Fourth Amendment kick in? Do we have to have probable cause that a crime was committed? We don't have to have probable cause that a crime was committed, but in that seizure warrant, they had to provide probable cause that the animals had been or are being cruelly treated. So before the judge ever signed the seizure warrant to allow them to go in and seize these 27,000 animals, they did have to find probable cause.
Isn't that a crime, though?
Isn't that a crime? Well, you're finding probable cause that the animals have been cruelly treated based on the definition in Chapter 821, which mirrors the elements that are part of the animal cruelty crime.
Right.
But because our concern when we're talking about cruelly treated animals is really the protection of the animals. So if we want to protect the animals by getting them out of the situation where they've been cruelly treated, we go through the civil process.
But wouldn't it, and I just want to protect ourselves here, you know, automatically what's the next step? Criminal charges. Can they go in, and this is all the evidence, can they go in and suppress it all?
Correct. Okay, so let's talk about that. The question on whether or not we would go to the criminal charges. So you heard at the end of that video clip that they said this is all part of a civil seizure in the municipal court. Criminal charges are pending, and they're waiting to see. Now, we know there are now federal criminal charges pending against the owners, Jason and Vanessa Shaw. They have both fled to Australia. I know the federal marshals are looking for them. I know those arrest warrants are still pending, but they did file criminal charges against them under federal federal statutes. Now, double jeopardy issues. If you find that the owner has cruelly treated the animal, does this prevent us from being able to file criminal charges down the road? And the answer is no. We have a case from 2009. This is from the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, State versus Almendarez. And the law said that double jeopardy does not bar remedial proceedings in a civil nature if we have criminal charges already filed, and vice versa. If we have found that there is civil cruel treatment of animals, it doesn't prevent us from filing criminal charges down the road. Now, the laws in Chapter 821 tell us that a guilty verdict or a conviction against an owner for animal cruelty is prima facie evidence in a civil hearing. But most times, the civil hearing is going to come first. I mean, they have 3 years to file animal cruelty charges against an owner, but we're concerned with protecting the animal, and we've got 10 days to get that animal out of the situation. So usually, we're going to have the civil hearing first, and then whatever happens with the criminal hearing or trial will happen down the road. The statement of an owner at the civil hearing, they're an interested party, whatever statements they make at the civil hearing is inadmissible at any trial for animal cruelty. Now, in the Arlington case, the owners didn't show up. They didn't come to the hearing. They sent their attorneys. But if they had shown up, anything they say at the civil hearing is inadmissible against them at an actual criminal trial for animal cruelty. However, they could still be charged criminally, and they have been. Now, if the question about whether or not we could suppress the evidence, in the criminal trial, they would have to do a suppression motion. And because the judge has found probable cause for the same elements, has found that there was probable cause that they were being cruelly treated, and that cruel treatment is the same evidence that would have to rise for the probable cause to for an arrest warrant, I don't know that they would have any kind of suppression claim. Well, the standard for the civil hearing, yes, the disposition standard is going to be different. We're going to be looking for a preponderance of the evidence that they have been cruelly treated. In a criminal matter, we'd be looking, just issue the warrant, it's still going to be probable cause. Yes, you still have to find probable cause, meaning it's more likely than not that this person has cruelly treated these animals. So in a criminal hearing, I don't know that they would ever have a suppression hearing. Now, as municipal judges, we're concerned with the civil hearing. We want to get those animals out of the owner's control as fast as possible. So you're looking just to see that there's probable cause, meaning it's a fair probability or more likely than not that the owner has cruelly treated or is cruelly treating these animals. If so, you sign the seizure warrant. Those animals get seized. You decide how to dispose of those animals based on finding whether there's a preponderance of the evidence that the owner has cruelly treated the animals. If you find that there is, you order the disposition. Whatever happens with the criminal charges later happens. Now, it is unfortunate that if the animals have been destroyed, then what is the evidence that the criminal attorney is going to be able to use to introduce that these animals have been cruelly treated? And that's why a lot of these cases stop at the civil level. Once the animals have been taken out of the owner's control, we don't usually go after them criminally because we've already gotten the animals safe and secure. But there are no double jeopardy issues when we're talking about future criminal charges pending. Again, we're always, most 99.9% of the time, we're going to have the civil hearing before any kind of cruelty, before any kind of criminal hearing. Yes? Yes. We don't have a definition of owner right now. Now, again, we're only talking about Chapter 821 of the Health and Safety Code. We do have a definition of owner in Chapter 822 when we talk about dangerous dogs. Under 821, we do not now have a definition of owner. However, we do have a bill that's passed this session. This was House Bill 963. We'll be summarizing this. It'll be in the recorder this summer. We'll talk about it in the legislative update. This is the only animal bill that passed this session. And House Bill 963 makes significant changes. It does define owner. And it tells us that the owner could be somebody who owns the animal or has care or custody of the animal. In that case, we would need to notify the person that the animal was seized from, as well as the owner if we can find the owner. Now, we still have the lingering questions. What happens if we don't know who the owner is? A lot of times, law enforcement will go somewhere, they'll find an animal that they think has been cruelly treated, they'll come, they'll want to seize that animal, but they don't know who the owner is. I heard one case where the person who they seized the animal from said, "I'm not the owner, this isn't my dog." And then the court didn't have an owner to notify. The law tells us we have to notify the owner of the date and time of hearing. So can we proceed with this hearing if the owner hasn't received notice? My initial thought would be no, because the owner is entitled to notice in a hearing. They're entitled to that due process. So we still have that issue of what happens if we can't notify the owner. House Bill 963 did give us a definition of owner. It tweaked the definition of cruelly treated just slightly, but we're not concerned about that right now. This won't take effect until September. It changed the way we do costs. Now the costs are to be ordered at the time of the hearing for everything but the cost of caring for the animal. And then if you order disposition, then you have a second finding, and that's going to be ordering the costs as well as ordering the cost for appeal. So you would actually set the appeal bond at the time of the hearing instead of afterwards, which in our case, this is all going to happen at the same time. That's why it slightly tweaked it. Now, the animal rights attorneys got very involved in these bills, and they have now added an amendment to House Bill 963 that says all appeals are done de novo, even out of a court of record, that the court's record gets sent over, no transcript, because everything is going to be done de novo. This is kind of the municipal courts of record took issue with this, but this bill did pass. And the owner is entitled to a jury trial on appeal if requested. It does not go as far to say that you're entitled to a jury trial at the municipal or justice court level, but it does say that they're entitled to a jury trial on appeal at the county level. And again, the appeal is going to be de novo. So what I see is going to happen is every time you have a cruelly treated animal hearing in municipal court, the owner's going to appeal it, and then they're going to get their jury trial in the county level, which means as you're doing these hearings, the disposition order is not going to be as important because they are going to get to go up on appeal, but it's going to be determining the costs so that you can set the appeal bond that's going to be the important part of the hearing for the municipal court level. Now, we talked about city regulation. Again, be concerned with your city ordinances. If something is covered under your city ordinances, follow your city ordinances. This is solely going under Chapter 821 of the Health and Safety Code. So if you have that city ordinance, make sure you look at it. Now, the problem that has come up, we have seen city ordinances that were not amended after the 2009 legislative amendments, whereas before you only had the right to appeal if your animal was ordered to be sold, not given away or destroyed. So the ordinances were drafted based on that, not granting you a right of appeal unless the animal was ordered sold. But now the state law gives you an appeal, a right to an appeal, if you're divested of ownership, period. So if your city ordinances have not been adapted to provide that right of appeal, then I think there is a preemption issue. And so look at your city ordinances and make sure that it does follow the Health and Safety Code enough to not be concerned with preemption. Okay, let's see. State law offenses. I've given you a chart in your handout that goes over the different criminal offenses that are going to be in the Health and Safety Code regarding animals. Again, there is no cruel treatment. The only thing that we would talk about that might be cruel treatment is unlawful restraint of a dog. So if you have a dog chained up in violation of state law, then that might be seen as a Class C misdemeanor in municipal court rather than a civil hearing. But if we're talking about cruel confinement, if we're talking about unreasonably abandoning, not providing food, water, or shelter, then you're probably only going to be seeing these as a civil hearing and never as a criminal matter unless you have that state law or that city ordinance in place. Now, I was going to give you one more example because, you know, we're talking about 27,000 animals, and how many of you are ever going to have 27,000 animals that you're going to have to order seized? But this happened out of the city of Alvin, another one that received quite a bit of press coverage. They seized 120 animals. This all stemmed from unrelated code enforcement issues for a house that there was a hoarding issue. Code enforcement officials went in and they found a dog tied near the door, and their city had a no tethering ordinance. So they were going to charge the owners under this no tethering ordinance. They called animal control, and animal control came in and found that there were more dogs on the property than were allowed on the city ordinances. Then they went and searched in the back of the yard. Because of these city ordinance violations, they were able to get a search warrant for the property for other code enforcement violations. They went in and they found lice on all the animals. They found 120 dogs, mini horses, cats, ponies, and guinea pigs that were in small crates. All the crates had inches of feces and urine. They found several dead puppies that were being eaten by other dogs. They found horses tied up in mud up to the underside of their belly where they couldn't move. They found horses that were so stuck in different forms of feces that they couldn't even lay down. And so this now became a cruelly treated animal case. It started as an unrelated code enforcement case. They found the tethering ordinance. They found the too many animals ordinance. They came in and investigated. It became a cruel treatment of animal cases. The city of Alvin, Judge Bill Pinnell, ordered that all of the animals be, that the owner be divested of ownership of all of the animals. And he ordered $19,497 worth of costs be paid. And in the order, he said those costs had to be paid within 30 days. Now, the one thing I want to point out that the animal control officers have been taught, they have been taught that in that disposition order, the judge should put in there that the owner is precluded from or prohibited from owning any more animals for 2 years. That is nowhere in the law. The law does not allow us to put that into the order. This is a civil matter. We don't have any deferred things where we can do any other reasonable condition. I think we're limited to specifically what the law allows in that disposition order. And the law only allows us to divest ownership of those animals that are the subject of the order, which will be in that caption, and the disposition and the payment of costs. So if you are asked to put that into the disposition order, I personally don't know that we have the authority to do that. I don't believe that we do have the authority to do that. Sorry? Right, just the owner can't come into the auction and buy the animals back. So with that said, just a closing final thought, but any questions on this? Again, if you haven't had a chance, read this journal, the article. We have a chart in here that tells us the steps to go through. Part two of this article just came out in last month's Recorder. It's on the dangerous dogs, and there will be part three in the fall, and we're going to go through all the still unanswered questions to see if we could get the legislature to take notice and try to make some of these changes next time. But sorry we don't have more specific answers for a lot of these. If you have any of these cases in your court, share your experiences with us because we want to be able to get the word out about these cases. And that said, here is my dog who is most definitely not cruelly treated. Everybody puts pictures of their kids at the end. I don't have kids, so this is my baby. But thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the conference.